Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Developer Express. Become a UI superhero with DevExpress, controls, and libraries. Deliver elegant .NET solutions that address customer needs today by leveraging your existing knowledge. You can build next-generation touch-enabled solutions for tomorrow. You can download your free 30-day trial at dx.hanselminutes.com. That's dx.hanselminutes.com. Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today I'm talking with Sarah Kunst. She is the founder and CEO at ProDay and a longtime investor and venture capitalist. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm very well. So your app, ProDay, is pretty amazing.
Thank you.
I've been checking out the website at proday.co, and it basically lets you work out with, you know, your favorite professional athletes and work alongside them. It's pretty clever idea, but this is not your first foray into business and companies. You've been doing startups and tech for a very long time.
I have, yeah, pretty much my entire career.
And one of the things that you said to me that I wanted to talk about today was how empathy matters in software development. But then I thought you were going to go in a certain direction. I thought you were going to talk about, you know, the importance of empathy for empathy's sake. But you said, no, this is about shipping cool stuff and this is about making money.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's important to be a good person because we live in a world that's very hard to live in if everyone's not a good person. But it's really, there's a business imperative too. And I think that sometimes that gets a little bit lost. And we feel like when we talk about things like empathy in design or in tech, it's sort of for the fuzzy reasons. And it is, but there's also a lot of cold, hard cash reasons too. So I'm excited to talk about that.
Yeah. And when did you start developing this perspective?
You know, I think for me, I remember in either high school or college, I was in a class learning about automobile design. I'm from Michigan. And so the big three automakers are way heavy on all of our minds there. And they were talking about how I think in the 60s, women had started to drive a lot more. And so they wanted to do a better job of selling cars to women. Or at least if you have a car that a woman hates and there's another car that the woman hates less, the odds are that, you know, the husband, even if he's the one making the purchase decision and it's in his name, is going to buy the car that the woman hates less. So they were working on this idea and, they got all the engineers, because all the engineers were men. They made them all come to work one day and they put them in skirts and heels and purses and gave them lipstick and all of this stuff, right? Perfume, like everything that women, you know, at the time were probably going to be wearing as they were in a car. And they made them, you know, do all of these tests dressed as women. And immediately the guys were like, oh my God, we need a place to put the purse. Like if you have all your stuff in this purse, you don't want it like in the back seat or flying around in the seat next to you. You step on the brakes and it goes flying. Like we need a place for the purse. Or they'd realize that if you were wearing like a tighter skirt and you're trying to get into the car, you really struggle because you can't sort of like hike one leg up and then sit and then the other. And so they just realized all of these things in like this 2-hour sort of test period that completely changed the way they thought about building cars, right? And it wasn't, or designing the interior of a car. And it wasn't that, that they were doing it because, you know, these auto workers were secretly feminist, right? They were doing it because they needed to be able to more effectively sell cars to half the population.
Interesting. They were presented a problem. The problem was, here, now you're wearing a skirt and you have a purse, make a very comfortable car. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. I don't understand why walking in someone else's shoes isn't so obvious, why we aren't starting our design from that root place.
Yeah. And it's even little things, right? Like I'm African American, but a lot of my friends are not. And so I started making sure that I have sunscreen because I would feel really bad when I would be, you know, friends would come over during the summer and, you know, they'd be like, oh my God, like we're going to go for this hike or whatever. Do you have sunscreen? And I'm like, no, sorry. And then they get these crazy sunburns. And to be fair, I've only gotten one sunburn in my life, and it was on a medication that made my skin photosensitive. I had no idea what it felt like. because like, try to imagine if you just never had a sunburn and you get a sunburn as an adult and you didn't realize you got a sunburn. Like I thought I was dying. I thought that I had had some sort of chemical burn or something over my entire body. I didn't know what it could be. I thought I was going to die. And I was explaining it to friends and they were so worried about me. And finally, one of them looked at me and said, Sarah, you have a sunburn. But I had no idea. And ever since then, I'm like, okay, I'm going to keep sunscreen on hand because I had no idea that like this is what was happening to my friends. And so it is obvious, but I think often we need a catalyst, either a business imperative or a personal experience that makes us go, oh, wait, I need to purposely think about other people's perspectives to make sure that they are happy or comfortable or lucrative or whatever your goal is.
One of the phrases that I'm not a big fan of in the news right now is this, as a father of daughters, and then the whole thing, why is it that something big has to happen to cause someone to be a catalyst for change? Why are we not taught that empathy for others right off the bat?
I think that we are taught empathy in a broad strokes sense, right? Like if anyone tells you, sorry, my mother just died, we have a knee-jerk empathy, right? So I think that we're taught that for big things or sort of really universal themes. I don't think that we are taught, I think that there's something that we do that is very well intended, but is not well executed, right? This idea of sort of, I don't see gender, I don't see race, I don't see whatever. Which is yes, like we understand, right? The same way that a baby doesn't really see gender or race, and that's good. You want a baby to love everyone. But I mean, babies also have to wear diapers because they can't control their bowel movements. Like as we grow up, we have to have more nuance around these things. And I think we have to say, you know, hey, what is it like if you know, another favorite example of mine is my dad is a foot taller than my mom. And so he hung a mirror once in their bathroom and my mom couldn't see in it because it was so incredibly tall because he just held it up at his head length and hung it because that's how you hang a mirror, right? If you want to use it to do your hair. And so it was just this really funny and small thing where, you know, my parents have been very happily married for 35 years. And even that doesn't mean that you're going to always have that sort of knee-jerk empathetic thought because it's not, it's hard to think about always, hey, how is this affecting the other people around me who need this product or who will use this product? And so I do think that there is, especially in engineering, a piece of it that needs to go into, you know, really the spec, right? When you're speccing out a product, when you're thinking about what you're going to build, who are the stakeholders? And then how are the stakeholders different from each other? I think is a piece of it that we sometimes miss and we just sort of build a product for ourselves and figure, hey, I'm a person. So if I like it, other people will like it. And that's not always the way it works.
It feels like that there's a sweet spot between understanding the person's perspective as well as just objectively speaking as an outsider. So there's value in being deeply empathetic, but there's also value in being detached.
Yeah. And I think that's part of it. I think that there's, I think you really do need to do both, right? You need to think about, hey, what do I want? Because I do think it's hard to build products that you're completely divorced from just because it's sort of more of an antiseptic process. So you do need to think like, I'm a human and I represent to some extent the human experience, right? What do I think, want, and need? But then also think about who are the other stakeholders and almost treat them all equally, right? I think that's a detachment piece where you don't say, well, this is what I want and 30% of the audience will want what I want. So we should prioritize that because I'm the one building it. But instead sort of treat every stakeholder as kind of equal and say, how do we build this in a way that will work for everyone? There used to be complaints about like the older iPhones that they were too small, right? Guys would say that's so tiny. I feel like, you know, I want a bigger phone. And then now you have these massive, massive, massive iPhones. And granted, Apple sort of, they decided not to go straight down the middle, right? They made the really, really big phones and then now they continue to make the smaller phones instead of just picking one. But if you give, you know, a 5-foot-tall woman one of the massive phones, she's like, I can't hold this. This is terrible. Like it's it's like a basically an iPad. If you give a 7 foot tall NBA player one of the little phones, they're like, I can't hold this. This is a phone for ants, you know? So it's important, I think, to think about those practical things and then decide, do we build two products? Is there a happy medium? Like, how do we meet these people's needs? But I do think a lot of it is even just having that moment of thinking about it. I think a lot of interesting solutions come from there.
How far do you go, though? I think that people on the naysayer side would say that in some ways we're being, and they use the word politically correct, I would just say overly inclusive. Like, you can't hit 100% because you could spend all of your time on that last 2%.
I mean, nobody, so one, engineers love spending all their time on the last 2%, right? Let's be honest. Prying a product out of an engineer's hand to push it into development when there's one tiny thing that could be fixed if we only had 7 more weeks is every product manager's biggest job. So one, you know, I think that engineers out of anybody have a unique skill set and interest in this sort of perfection. I don't think it's politically correct. Again, it's about money. Right. And if you are an engineer and you run a company or you work at a company, you really want your company to make money so that you can keep getting a paycheck and eventually sell for billions of dollars. Right. So your stock price goes up and your equity is worth more. So, you know, the business case is we live in a, you know, capitalist economy in America and lots of other places around the world, and money makes the world go round, fortunately or unfortunately. So if you're talking about doing something that cuts out half of, you know, the population, there is a famous example, again, of Apple. They released their Apple Health Tracker, and they didn't just sort of say, oh yeah, here's Apple Health Tracker. They said, this is the most comprehensive health tracker in the history of the world, and this is the best health tracker ever. Guess what they did not do at all? They did not track women's menstruation. So 50% of the world, right? And I would say probably a solid, assuming that the average Apple iPhone user is north of 12 and south of, you know, let's say 65, right? 80, 90% of the population of women using iPhones could track their periods. They have periods, and this was not built in. And again, it's fine if you say, oh, it's a basic health tracker. If you tell me it's the most comprehensive health tracker and you are not tracking something that happens to literally every single woman for a solid 30 to 40 years of her life, at least, it's hard to believe that it's the most comprehensive health tracker, right? And so things like that, and they got a lot of backlash for it. And you know, they also missed out on market share because in that hole, a lot of other health apps popped up. And even now, anytime you download a health app onto Apple, Apple's begging you to use Apple Health and let you write to it. But the reason in large part that you're downloading these other apps in the first place is because their super comprehensive app wasn't so comprehensive after all. So, you know, those kinds of business cases, I think, are beyond obvious. And I certainly would be hard pressed to say that worrying about 50% of your user base is political correctness or overly inclusive, right? That's sort of just boilerplate. So, you know, I think yes, there's always things on the margins, but a lot of what we're talking about are basic block and tackle things that just haven't happened.
Mm-hmm. I found an interesting article on your website on proday.co under fitness about the Nike Pro hijab. And again, it's something that kind of the average person that looks like me might think, well, that's kind of obscure. But when you look at the article, it's really quite interesting because it all started with a female weightlifter who was discovering that the one hijab she had that was competition appropriate had issues with weight. It would shift while she was moving. Yeah. It caused breathability issues. As I was reading about this, I would have to say my thoughts and opinions about whether or not that's a good product or not turned into engineering questions. I started to think about it in terms of engineering. Okay, yeah. This is a problem. We got to solve this problem. Apparently, they worked very hard on this to come up with an athletic hijab.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when you think about it, right, in America, we don't see this, but around the world, being Muslim, it's the largest, it's basically a religion that's neck and neck in terms of, with Christianity, in terms of penetration around the world, right? And on top of that, there's a disproportionate amount of Muslim people in emerging markets And as we all know, right, emerging markets are where a lot of explosive growth is going to come from, right? Everybody in America who wants to buy a piece of Nike workout gear, right, has a piece of Nike workout gear. You might want more pieces. They might come out with a fun new color or technology, but we all have, you know, more basketball shorts and leggings and t-shirts, right, than we know what to do with for the most part in this country. And similar, right, in most of Europe. But then you look at places like Indonesia, places like India, places where a lot of this, you know, sort of organized sports are just starting to take off in terms of worldwide competition, right? And there is a massive opportunity to sell products to those people, right? And so, of course, you're going to optimize for, hey, there's a massive emerging market that we're desperate to get a piece of. And not only do we want a piece of it in general, we also, you know, a lot of times what will happen in an emerging market, we've certainly seen this in India over the years, is that they don't necessarily want American products, right, or European products. They want a brand that is sort of from where they're from and speaks to them more directly. And so then when you start to look at that, you go, oh, wait a minute, if we don't necessarily just get to go in, it's not like in China or Russia, where when American brands came to those countries, there was a massive pent up demand and excitement for them, right? Their American brands aren't always the most desirable always now. And so instead of somebody launching their own, you know, Nike in these regions, right? Nike for Muslim people, Nike has to be in front of the business case and say, we really don't want to lose this customer, right? This customer doesn't own any Nike gear and they could buy a lot of Nike gear. So how do we get in front of them and build that relationship? And it is using their engineering resources. It is using, you know, their marketing resources, but it's also just having that empathy in the engineering and design to build what makes sense for that customer.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I've been excited about, and I've started to realize in looking at the products and things that I use myself, is that a lot of them are built by smaller companies. You know, with the rise of Etsy, we're getting design thinking and empathy from products that people are building in their garages. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no reason that Nike needs to own that market. Other people could.
Exactly. And the good part about that, right, the internet sort of making that super flat and accessible, and you see people, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with Yeti coolers. They're a brand, I think, out of Austin, Texas, or somewhere down south. And they've grown into this billion-dollar behemoth because they realized that there is a massive need for, you know, well-designed and attractive, super, super, super durable coolers, and it wasn't being met. And that's something that, you know, Amazon can have a billion different coolers that they're selling, but they're sort of optimizing for what's the cheapest, what's the whatever, you know, and this was a brand that somebody built it to solve their own problems. And I think that's sort of the opposite of what I was saying, but also a continuation of it. When you, if everyone at some extent is engineering things to solve their own problems, or you're always biased towards solving your own problems first, then I don't believe really in trying to fight human nature on things. So if that's the way humans are, okay. So then if everyone looks the same, is from the same university, lives in the same town, then their problems are going to be much more similar. If we have a much broader range of backgrounds, experiences, you know, and perspectives in an engineering pod, right, then we can actually solve for our own problems, but we're going to do it in a much more empathetic way because we're bringing a lot of different perspectives to the table.
Just as a bit of an anecdote, I think I've talked to you before that I'm a type 1 diabetic and I wear an insulin pump. Even though I've been doing this for 25 years, and one could argue that I'm one of the most empathetic diabetics out there about diabetes stuff. I was talking with a lady at my kid's school who is also a diabetic, and she was complaining about how she had nowhere to put her insulin pump. And I didn't understand why it wasn't in her pocket. Her clothes have pockets. There's so many clothes for women that have no pockets. Yeah. She has a custom bra with an insulin pump pocket. There is actually an insulin pump bra market.
Absolutely. And that's the type of thing, right? That you would just, as soon as you said that, I knew exactly what you were talking about because, you know, being a woman, you constantly, I actually, you know, I work out a lot. And so, it's so hard guys, it's really hard to find gym shorts that don't have pockets. Right. But you almost never see girls in the gym in like basketball shorts, right? Leggings almost never have pockets because of the way they're designed. And it's such a pain. Like, I can't tell you how many times my phone has gone flying during the middle of a workout because it's not in a pocket. And so recently I've started only buying, you know, leggings and workout clothes and stuff that have pockets in them. Because before that, I would have to wear a coat to the gym strictly because I needed a place to put my phone while I was working out. You can do the armbands, but they're a pain. And so it's so interesting how something like that to half the population is obvious and to the other half, it's not. And it has nothing to do with, you know, your preferences or biases or anything. It's just you go into the store and you buy pants and she goes into the store and she buys pants. Your pants will have pockets 100% of the time. Women's pants will have pockets that actually work and are big enough for an insulin pump, maybe 30% of the time, you know? And it's pretty crazy what a difference that makes.
It really does. So how are you applying all of these concepts around design thinking and empathy into the products that you make, like Pro Day?
Yeah. So you know, especially on mobile phones, it is interesting when you are working on a platform that has so many constraints that are completely above your pay grade, right? So anybody who's built apps for Apple or products on Apple, you know, you can't just say, oh, well, I think this should happen. Apple says, no, this is the way that you can play within our walled garden, right? And so that is always an interesting challenge. And we have a lot of conversations about fringe cases. I know that a lot of times those can feel more like thought experiments. And to be totally honest, sometimes they are thought experiments. But what I've found is that by having those discussions, right, it makes, when you have those discussions, it means that it's at least on your radar, right? So we might say, oh, you know, should we have a logging tool or should we have a, you know, a way to read the website that is super easy to use if you know, with disabilities? And then we say, honestly, we don't have disabilities. We don't know what that looks like. So then we might start with, you know, Googling and finding like a Medium article or something about developer who, you know, has low hearing or poor vision and what their top things to think about, right, when building an app for those populations. We might look into Apple's documentation itself and say, okay, what does Apple do, right? Are there solutions? Sometimes you want to build a solution, then you find out, oh no, Apple actually, you know, has a disability mode that does XYZ already. And so it's not always, and I think this is a big part of it, when you set out to engineer with empathy, it's not always that you end up building fundamentally different solutions. To some extent, you're just taking the sort of surprise out of it, right? It's like the QA process. Sometimes you go through QA and you find huge giant bugs that you have to fix. Other times you go through QA and you've done everything perfectly and it works and it can ship, right? It doesn't mean that if you do QA and there are no bugs, you wouldn't say, okay, I'm done, right? Like I'm never doing QA again. I've clearly imperfect and it'll never be wrong again. It's still a needed kind of thought experiment to go through. And so, you know, that I think is an important thing to remember, that you don't want to say, oh, well, it was all, you know, I don't understand what we would need to change or there was nothing to change. So, you know, don't worry about it, is really not the way to go. You really do need to say every time, okay, you know, it worked this time, but we're still going to keep investigating it. And I think when you keep that mindset, really interesting things pop up. And the other cool thing about engineering is you never know when, by being more empathetic, you're going to stumble onto a whole massive market that you would have not seen otherwise. And so I think that there's a huge business case for it. And it's also kind of fun, you know, it being in that stage of learning and just thinking about new problems and new ways is one of the best parts of engineering.
Yeah, it's interesting because I'm sitting here thinking about how what we used to think of as niches, there are no niches. If it's 1% of the world, it's still a massive market. So what you're saying is absolutely true. You could build a billion-dollar company on a niche.
Absolutely.
Interesting. So when do you think we need to learn teach this in schools? Is empathy in design and empathy in software development something that needs to be taught in CS 101?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it is a, I think in every part of product development, right? So from thinking about why are you building a product in the first place to, you know, design to engineering, it's an integral part of it, right? And I think it's especially in engineering because so often engineers are the ones, you know, the designer might say, hey, this is what I want. But often if it comes down to pushback from the engineers, right, that they're going to win out because they're the ones actually building it, right? So if engineers understand why this empathy matters, they might see something in the design or in the product spec that doesn't seem intuitive to them or doesn't seem useful or needed. And I think that having that grounding and understanding and, hey, here's the business case and the innovation case for why we care about empathy is super helpful. And I do think the earlier you start, the better, right? If you've ever spent time on college campuses with engineers, they always, you know, typically at that stage in your life, you know, you don't have a ton of experience in life because, you know, you've never had to buy a car by yourself maybe or have a mortgage or had kids. And so a lot of times you'll see that college engineers sort of always want to build the same tools, right? Every college is like, oh, there's not enough parking on campus, or we need to build an app for parking, or there's not, you know, we need something so we can play video games with other friends easier. We don't want to use Twitch. It's slightly better than Twitch. And we've taught engineers to kind of think their way through the sort of startup roadmap of, does that make sense? Is that good? Is that what we want to do? And we've done a good job of getting them to think through that. I think that the space that we are missing is how do we get them to think through some of these empathy challenges in the same way, right? And it's not hard. It's just another piece of good engineering and good design and good product development that we need to teach early.
Mm. It's so interesting that now we seem to find these things, if we don't teach them up front, we end up finding them in user testing, like the now legendary faucet detector that can't see black hands.
Exactly. Or, you know, in China, the face unlock is being unlocked by other people. And, you know, it's certainly not, these are, you know, when you get to things like AI and machine learning, right, which is a largely what the face lock is, it's not at that point, you know, a human. When we teach machines, right, machine learning means that we're teaching machines basically everything that they can learn from us, depending on how wide those parameters are. And so if you teach them how to tell Asian faces apart, they can tell Asian faces apart. If you don't, then they can't, right? And so as technology sort of gets exponentially better, the fallout or the risk of making the wrong decisions or not being, you know, empathetic enough early on get bigger, right? One thing that I thought was really interesting about the soap dispensers that can't see black hands is there was a question, you know, that I saw on Twitter that said, what happens if self-driving cars have the same problem? Right. Mm. And it's a massive thing to think about. And it's, you know, and we see that in simple machinery, right? 5-year-olds can't sit in the front seat because they're not heavy enough generally for the airbag detector to go off, right? It's not that car companies want to kill your kindergartner. It's just that the way that product is engineered, and I think it's also the way the seatbelts are, but, you know, the way that product is engineered is unsafe for certain populations. And we know that and we accept that. But with technology, sometimes we think, oh, well, it works equally. It's technology. It can't be racist. It can't be sexist. It just works. But that's not always the way it does. And so there are some big questions that we have to grapple with. And quite frankly, not only would it be terrifying if self-driving cars couldn't see black people and started running them over, it would also be a public relations and financial nightmare for these companies that they very well might not survive. So from an empathy perspective and from a business perspective, like, these things have to be solved.
Yeah. I think that point, though, that the root point that really hit me, what you just said, was you can't say, oh, it's just technology. It just works. It was made by people. It was coded by people. It was designed by people for people. So the idea that people think that technology can't be, by its definition, excluding, mm-hmm. That's just wrong. You know, an interesting story that you might be interested in, my family came over from South Africa, mm-hmm. and they were shocked at how many ramps there were. They could not get there. They were just like, there's ramps everywhere.
Yeah.
And they were freaking out. And I was like, well, yeah, there was a law like, you know, 40 years ago called the Americans with Disabilities Act. We have to have ramps so people can get up. Mm-hmm. And then they started realizing that stairs are exclusive.
Yeah.
Excluding. And they thought that everyone needs to have that. We should have ramps for everybody. I thought that was so interesting. They came from a town that just didn't have ramps.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy?
It is. And for me to go and think.
Crazy. It makes complete sense, right? Like, why would you have ramps everywhere? But we do sort of take it for granted. Yeah. It's interesting how, and you know that, and we didn't touch on that and we're running out of time, but that the reason that America has so many ramps, right, and elevators and everything else is because of actually legislation, because it wasn't apparent and obvious to anyone until a group of people got together and advocated for it and it became a law. You know, and mm-hmm. so I think most engineers and most people in technology, we like to solve our own problems before and not get to the point where government feels like they should step in and regulate. But then that becomes an issue of self-regulation, right? If you are, you know, in a wheelchair or if you just broke your leg, you shouldn't not be able to get into buildings for, you know, any building ever. Like that's an insane way to live. And so it was changed. And hopefully with some of these technology questions, we can take ownership of these issues and make the world a more empathetic place ourselves so that we don't end up, you know, with government regulators coming in and saying, hey, you know, you guys have to build ramps. This can't just be a stairway world.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us today, Sarah Kunst.
Thank you.
You can check out Sarah at proday.co and on Twitter. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.